Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and I'm at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., where all week long they're having citizens' hearings on disclosure, UFO disclosure. I have one of the key speakers with me right now. He's going to be testifying in front of former members of Congress tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., and I have with me Peter Davenport, who's the head of the
National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, or actually in Washington, Eastern Washington now. It was founded in Seattle.
Right, and Peter's been in charge of taking reports on UFOs since for the last 15 years, right?
About 19, since August of 1994.
And Stephen Bassett invited you here to this hearing because of your research is so important in...
Well, it's important. I'm not sure it's correct to call it research.
Okay.
I am a secretary, in a sense, mm-hmm. in the sense that I provide a conduit for UFO reports. When somebody sees a UFO anywhere in the United States or for that purpose anywhere in the world, mm-hmm. they can call our hotline or contact our website and submit a report to our center. What it is again, simply... If people are interested in submitting reports to us, we will post them, and we will let the world know what's going on.
So in 19 years, how many reports have you received?
I can only but estimate.
Yes.
But I would say easily 200,000 reports in 19 years.
And you're...
And it may run higher than that.
200,000 reports in 19 years, and you are the sole researcher? You're taking 200,000 reports?
Over 19 years. However, the proviso there is not everybody elects to follow up with a written report.
Okay.
One of my greatest frustrations is trying to get Americans to write down things, whereas they usually want to talk about them. Talking about it doesn't capture the information. What I try to convince the callers, the witnesses to do is write that information down. And that is rather...
Well, it's much easier now that they have the internet. When you started, we were just taking phone calls, and now people can first, and I was part of a report, submit a report online, and then you follow up with it.
Follow up to the best of my ability. But mm-hmm. we are not, technically speaking, simply because we don't have the resource that mm-hmm. permits us to investigate or even follow up on every report that comes in. We are a conduit of information for incoming reports. We proofread them. In order to eliminate profanity, eliminate personal information from the report, we guarantee anonymity to anybody who contacts our center, whether by phone, by internet, and we remove any personal information from the report, and then we simply post it to our website to let people see raw reports themselves if they wish to do.
Colleagues, Dr. Desiree Hertog and Dr. J.J. Hertog, but I'll probably talk to them after I finish talking to you because it's a whole who's who of ufologists here in Washington. And so tomorrow, what is it that you're going to focus on in front of the former members of Congress?
Well, I think I'm going to try to emphasize how much data we're getting to underscore the fact that we appear almost without any doubt at all, I say this, we appear to be dealing with a real phenomenon. Which is what it appears to be, namely dealing with reports from people who claim to have seen craft mm-hmm. objects which transcend in every respect flight performance characteristics that any terrestrial aircraft has. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. I've anguished for the longest time on what I should talk about, but I think I'm going to talk about what I know best.
Uh-huh.
I would be remiss to do anything but that, and that's the reports that are coming into our center, which we have posted to our website.
But how many of those reports, 200,000 approximately, are proved to be something other than, or proved to be identified?
Well, the ones we post,
yeah.
we have posted... somewhere between 70 and 75,000 reports to our website.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody just pointed out to me that it is probably the largest database of sighting reports on the internet today. I can't confirm that. But I'm fairly draconian when it comes to winnowing out bad reports. They're pranks, they're cases of mistaken identity and so on. And I either delete those or qualify them properly so the person reading the report will recognize that this is probably something other than a report of a genuine UFO.
You said to me yesterday that there seems to be a huge increase just in the last, was it 6 months? Talk about that.
10 months ago. I've talked about it extensively on radio programs. I've written articles, published articles on it. Approximately the second or third week of June last year, 2012, I noted a sudden spike in the volume of reports. We went in rough round figures from somewhere between 250 and 350 reports per month posted to approximately 900 to 1,000 reports in 1 month.
That's tripled.
Almost tripled.
Yeah.
Certainly doubled.
What's going on?
Well, I don't know. My impression is we have rounded the corner in some respect that I don't understand in ufology. That is a significant increase. That is a statistically significant increase in the number of reports. But one noteworthy thing that has me a little bit concerned and a little bit confused is that the bulk of those reports, and anybody is welcome to go and see those reports. If
What's the website again?
UFOcenter.com.
Okay.
Nine letters, one word, UFOcenter.com.
Okay.
They can look at the reports themselves. The bulk of those reports, I think I'm correct in saying, consist of reports of red, orange, yellow, amber, or yellow fireballs in clusters of half a dozen, a dozen, several dozen. I think the largest number I've had reported to me was in the vicinity of 150 of those objects. What they are, I don't know. In some cases, quite clearly, they could be so-called Chinese lanterns or fireballs or sky lanterns, some people call them. And indeed, we've been able to determine that some of these cases that have been reported to us have been caused by that phenomenon, by those types of hot air balloons.
Actually, one that I report, a friend of mine reported, was exactly that. But before he knew Kurt Johnson, didn't know what it was, and reported it to your center and then said, oops, it was a Chinese lantern. So,
well, it's even rather difficult. It's equally difficult, I would say, to prove a Chinese lantern over a UFO than vice versa. What you have to do is find the lantern.
Yeah.
You have to find the point where it was launched from. Mm-hmm. You have to talk to the people who launched it. And still, you have to follow up and do investigation. But there are some cases, and I would say the majority of cases easily, in which we can show that the cluster of objects was moving in one direction, whereas we know that the wind, the prevailing wind, was moving in another. What that tells us is that the objects were self-propelled.
Right. I get that. So you're so out over 19 years, 200,000 report. What are the patterns that you're noticing? Has there been a shift in pattern? Can you trace that?
The only shift or the only pattern I can see is the one I just alluded to, this sudden dramatic increase in reports and a shift in the nature of the bulk of the reports. What these objects are, I have no idea. But my instincts are telling me, together with some modest investigation, as much as I'm able to do with the resources I have, tells me that these things are anomalous. We have no explanation for them. If anybody doubts what I'm saying, I would invite them to go to the data for the 10th of November, 2012. Let me summarize briefly what happened that afternoon. I was working at the hotline at the National UFO Reporting Center, and calls started coming in from Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Coral Springs, as I recall, Orlando, Miami, and a number of other places. I think we've received four or six reports from Florida in rapid sequence. In very short order, they were being reported from Georgia. Shortly after that, we started receiving reports from the Carolinas, North and South Carolina. They moved up to New York, New England. They seem to have then jumped, if we're talking about one group of objects, out to the Midwest. We started getting reports from Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and so on.
So they started in Florida. Whatever it was probably the same object. Is that what you're trying to saying here?
It's intriguing to consider that possibility. We could be talking about multiple clusters of objects. I haven't talked to the occupants of these objects.
Right.
But shortly after that, of great concern to me, because I live in eastern Washington state, is we started receiving reports from Washington state. One of the most dramatic was submitted by an airline pilot with 37 years experience in that capacity, who at 18:28 hours, 6:28 p.m., mm-hmm. on Saturday the 10th of November, and you can read his report on our website. I've talked to this gentleman probably half a dozen or eight times. He's very, very skilled, very conservative, very factual, very objective. He reported to us, both over our hotline and in subsequent follow-up written report, that at 8:28 p.m., he was driving east out of Castle Rock, which is roughly 60 or 70 miles north of Portland on the Interstate 5. He reported that as he was driving east on Highway 504, well-known highway, he looked out to his quartering right, to the southeast, that is, as he drove to the east, and he was not just alarmed, he was shocked, he admitted to me, to see three orange objects descending, and it was his impression that if they continued the trajectory that he was looking at, they would land on the highway in front of him.
Orange-colored lights.
Orange-colored lights.
And what happened, though?
He stopped his car. He sat there, I presume, for a few seconds, watching this display of lights. He turned his car around. He was so alarmed by what he saw, he turned his car around. He drove back the opposite direction, back into Castle Rock to, one, get his camera, number two, pick up his wife and take her back out there. He admitted to me, I've had many conversations with this man.
Mm-hmm.
He admitted to me that in his opinion, and I think this may be written in his written report, that is the only time while operating a piece of equipment, an aircraft or an automobile, that he came close to panic. That was how emotional he was over the display in front of him.
Because he couldn't explain it. It was so shocking.
It was so shocking. He had no explanation for it. It was anomalous in nature. The objects, I may be paraphrasing him, but his impression was that they were under intelligent control. So he turned around and returned to his home, got his wife, got his camera, returned to the site where he had last seen the objects, and they were gone by the time he got back.
Is that a common feature of the reports, a sort of panic, hysteria, or not?
There's no common feature to these reports. Okay. Each one is as unique as a snowflake. That's one of the things an experienced investigator looks for, is emotion, emotional involvement.
Right.
A lot of kids submit prank calls to our center.
They do.
It's the bane of my existence. But you have to put up with it in order to get to the good information, of course. That's one of the things you can use, one of the characteristics of a call you can use to determine whether this person is submitting a serious report or perhaps a less than serious report of hoax.
I mean, just a few more questions is that what are some of the reports that really stand out in your mind over these last almost 20 years? Is there a few that, boom, you'll never forget?
Absolutely. The first one that comes to mind, of course, is the Phoenix Lights case, March 1997, March 13th, Thursday night. In my opinion, probably the most dramatic UFO event that has occurred in the history of ufology. To give our listeners, if they don't know about it, a few glimpses into what happened that afternoon, that evening. Now, after thorough analysis of the five triangular objects, perhaps a disc as well, we can say with good assurance that the wingspan of these triangular craft was not less than 7.4 miles, statute miles.
Of one craft?
One craft.
But they were just lights, right?
They
were not. Oh, okay. I didn't
read the reports on our website.
Okay, so people actually saw an object, because I thought it happened at not. I mean, this is what I haven't
at
investigated like
okay.
you.
Let me explain. I'd like to explain
please,
this.
Please. Of course. I wish you would.
Let me say parenthetically, the thing that confuses me about my work is we are collecting these reports at great personal expense in terms of time and treasury.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about them on the radio. We're putting out copious quantities of data on these incidents, and people still do not understand, for example, in the case of the Phoenix Lights, what went on there. It was a hugely dramatic event.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me attempt to justify that 7.4 mile statute mile mm-hmm. wingspan.
Please.
Mrs. Susan Watson, who works at a local Catholic school in downtown Phoenix, lives just about a mile south of Camelback Mountain, not very far from the intersection of 7th Avenue and Indian School Road. That night, she was closing up her house. She was preparing to take four of her children, two of her sons, two of her daughters, to an Irish music festival in preparation for St. Patrick's Day. While she was turning off lights and locking doors, she heard her kids out in the front yard start screaming to have her come out. She walked out of her house. She looked up and was thunderstruck by the object that was hovering over her neighborhood.
What time of day was this?
This was about 8:20 p.m. on a Thursday night.
Uh-huh.
Well, she was completely baffled by what she was looking at. Her two sons, teenagers at the time, lay down on their backs on the ground. This object wasn't just streaking overhead. It had stopped. It was in a hover mode, and she estimates that the object was sitting above her house for not less than 5 minutes.
Mm.
Well, they had an opportunity to survey the ventral surface of this craft and also estimate the angle that this object intersected or subtended above their head. When I asked her during a television program to hold up her arms and show me how big the object was above her arms, it was about 135-degree angle with her arms almost stretched out wide.
So it completely filled the whole sky. Oh, you had a comment, Dr. Hertog?
Yes, I wanted to say that this is a very important case, and one of my dear colleagues, Jim Dellatoso, who was one of the foremost investigators of UFO phenomena in terms of image enhancement analysis, took a closer look at the film documents and would agree with what Peter has just affirmed, that this is one of the most massive sightings consistently seen by literally thousands of people on the highest levels and on the most practical levels. We are seeing a massive preparation of orientation, according to Jim Dellatoso and myself, that is going to, shall we say, break the ice on this whole cover-up situation.
Okay, but we'll get, but so back to, thank you for that, back to your reporting, the reports that came to you.
Yeah.
So this woman sees it, it hovers over her house for 5 minutes, her children lay down and look at it, they kind of judge, and then what else happens that makes it so dramatic?
Suddenly, she reports, and I have all of this on tape, and in fact, people can hear her testimony on the internet, 3 hours of testimony on the Jeff Rentz radio program, by just typing in Susan Watson, Phoenix Lights, and going to the audio of what she had to say. Well, suddenly, all of the five lights on the object above their head seemed to extinguish as if somebody were turning down a rheostat on overhead lights. And the object suddenly accelerated almost faster than her eyes could track it. And it shot down to the Phoenix airport, Sky Harbor Airport. And as it was departing the overhead position above her home, it shot down a laser-like beam of light that she thinks struck the ground.
Was it like a blue beam or a white beam?
Interesting. It's a white beam.
Uh-huh.
Now, I say interestingly because lasers cannot be white. A laser is a chromatic bit of light. It's either red or blue or green, but you don't have white lasers. As according to our understanding of technology, you can't do that. So it was a beam of something, and we may never know what it was, but the one thing I would add, and then I'll relinquish my soapbox here.
No, I'm really appreciating you know, accuracy of reporting, your dedication to this cause, because without people like you, we'd be lost in the dark.
I'm afraid that's the case. I agree with your statement entirely. We in the field of ufology are very specialized investigators, mm-hmm. and we're coming up with information that, in my estimate, is bone-crushing in its importance, and much of it seems to be very highly reliable data from qualified witnesses.
Well, yeah, I just want to say one more thing about that. It's you make people's experience credible. You know, I could be on my own and see something and hesitate, but going to your website, hearing your reporting of it, it validates what happened to me. I have seen things, so I think it can't be more important.
By saying, again, I concur completely with what Peter is saying. I knew Dr. Ted Maimon, who was considered to be the father of one of the discovery of the laser, and Russell Targ at Stanford Research Institute, also a top laser specialist. You don't have the white light or the superluminal light projections from a laser. This is something far beyond American-made or Russian-made technology.
And one codicil I would like to add to my statements and Dr. Hertog's statements here a moment ago. We have evidence, strong evidence in my opinion, that at approximately the same time that all of the lights extinguished on that craft and it suddenly streaked to the south, firing out this momentary brief flash of light, I hesitate to call it a laser because I don't think it was a laser. We have strong evidence that I've played on many, many radio programs that craft was just being pursued by two F-15C fighters that had been launched out of Luke Air Force Base.
Oh.
And it raises the possibility that that flash of light was some kind of warning to the approaching aircraft. I can only but conjecture on this.
It almost reminds me of the Stevensville, Texas case a little bit, where there was a huge craft and pursued. But finish the Phoenix Light story, because as you said, it's the most spectacular documented case in history.
It is. It lasted, I estimate, for 2 hours and 5 minutes. It involved, allegedly, and I have to say allegedly, but on very, very good evidence, on the testimony of a U.S. Air Force airman from Luke Air Force Base who allegedly had been involved in that intercept, who has now disappeared. He disappeared the day after he contacted the National UFO Reporting Center. He called our center. He was clearly dejected to report to me that he had just come from his colonel's office and he had been apprised that he was going to be transferred to Greenland, to an Air Force base in Greenland, and we have not heard back from that gentleman since.
Wow.
And he said that not only had he been transferred there, but he would be there within 24 hours.
Because he reported this? Is that why he did report?
I presume that's the case. But I can't certify that because we haven't been able to talk to him since.
Okay, so there's this one first report is from the Indian Schoolhouse Road there.
Indian School Road and 7th Avenue.
Right, in Phoenix. And then it heads south towards the airport. And then what happens?
Where it was reported by a number of pilots. In fact, one flight crew was sitting in their aircraft at the gate, just about to be pushed back from the gate. And one of the crew members looked up through the overhead window, and he could see this craft hovering over or in the vicinity of Sky Harbor Airport. Well, they actually requested permission to not back away from their loading dock. Because they weren't going to take off with that object hovering above.
These pilots that weren't going to take off, you're
saying?
Yeah,
they delayed their pushback from the gate.
So then what happened in Phoenix?
Well, what I've just described.
No, but after that, I mean, how many people roughly would you say, not everyone, of course, reported, but how big a population saw this?
We can only guess at that.
Yeah.
Now, how many people would have been out at between 8 and 10 p.m. on a Thursday night, the 13th of March, I can only guess at. But we've accumulated about 1,500 reports.
Well, someone mentioned there's a about that time, so maybe more people were out? Or
a unique event? I'm talking to Desiree Hertog here.
There was some sort of reason why people were out. It was some sort of...
That may be the case. I'm sure I don't know everything about this event, but it was hugely dramatic. Now, how many people saw it? We will never know. That out of somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 people who witness a UFO, 10,000 to 20,000 people who see a UFO, these are adult, clear-thinking, competent American individuals with normal senses. If they see a UFO, my estimate has become only one of that 10,000 or 20,000 will ever report it in any kind of meaningful way.
Wow, that is less than, a tenth of a percentage of, so it's probably true because...
Closer to a hundredth of a percent.
A hundredth of a... So that's pretty phenomenal statistic.
Or half that even.
Well, yeah. It's...
Excuse me for interrupting.
Yeah, no, please.
The reason we don't know more about the UFO phenomenon is not because of the government. It's because of the American people who do not report their sightings.
So if you see a sighting, report it to Peter Davenport at the UFO Reporting Center.
Right. There, actually, I'm not the only organization involved in this type of operation, this type of reporting. There's MUFON, of course. There's Brian Veit. There's UFOBC. George Filer takes some reports. There are probably a dozen people whom I could cite whose judgment I trust, whose data I trust. And so people, if they want to report their sighting, would have no problem on the internet finding somebody to report it to. We're one of the more prominent. I think we have an assemblage of reports on the internet currently. I think we have about 72 or 76,000 reports.
How many do you follow up on? If it's reported, what do you?
Well,
what happens then?
I follow up in the sense that I try to return all phone calls. I try to respond to reports, but I'm one person working solo. And without a staff, without a budget, without a facility, I do everything I can.
I'll let you go. So, I know you're speaking tomorrow and there's a lot to do, but I do need to ask you just one question. Out of all the reports, the 200,000, how many of those UFO sightings include occupants or beings of some sort? What percentage?
It's hard for me to commit to a percentage.
Or how many?
Because I don't know.
What's the number that you might remember?
I hesitate to quantify it because I haven't counted it, and forgive me.
No, it's okay.
We have had a few reports of that nature, but relatively few.
Relative, because it's mostly lights or craft.
Lights or craft. I think that characterizes it best. Right. And craft can be any of many things. Mm-hmm. They can be the typical disc.
Yeah.
Although I just checked our data recently, and for every disc report we have, there are two reports of triangles, boomerangs, chevrons, that is triangular-shaped craft.
Right.
I just wrote an article on this subject. So,
where's the article? Where can we find it?
It will appear in a book that's about to be published. Author is Dave Marler. His book will be out within a month or two. It's being proofread now by Richard Dolan, the reporter and author. He is doing the proofreading and is going to be involved in the publication. I don't know the details of it, but it's going to be a very exciting book,
I
think.
Okay, so your website again?
Is ufocenter.com.
Okay.
Very simple.
Okay.
Nine letters. Couldn't be simpler. We made it to be simple.
Okay.
If anybody sees a UFO, we would like them to write out a detailed written report of what they saw, to include where they were, what direction they were looking, the angle of elevation, the perceived size of the object.
How many people you were with, of course.
How many people they were, the witness was with. And in fact, we'd like multiple reports if there were multiple witnesses. One of the things we like to get is multiple independent reports from different witnesses to the same event, because I think common sense dictates that two different people looking at even the same event will oftentimes see, remember, and report different aspects of it. So we encourage people to report.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you for your hard work, years of dedication, and the importance to an underground movement that's trying to bring to truth the nature of reality. I mean, I, what we're learning here at the citizens' hearings is that there's an element in our government that is trying to keep the truth from us.
Absolutely. That is my perception. That is my opinion. I don't have the proof that that is the case, although I've talked to enough people in senior positions of seniority or influence who agree with your assessment, and I happen to agree with it as well. We're being lied to by a government.
Well,
and we have to turn that around if we want to continue surviving as a free people.
That's why what you're doing is so important. You are giving a voice to the people.
I think it's crucially important to give them a conduit for this information. So if they see a UFO, they may report it, where the information will be stored, where it will be made available publicly, where it will be made available so that people may understand what's going on.
Well, don't give up then, Peter. I know you're getting a little, I mean, it's almost 20 years on the job, but someone has to do it.
I want to second also Peter's work being outstanding.
Yeah.
So for those in the audience who hear the message and the testimony, we are coming really into a whole critical mass of decision-making on the highest of levels. And we support those scientists and researchers who are still on the fence, who have the data but not necessarily the interpretive skills of what this is pointing to. Peter and I believe that the message is a positive one. For the sake of the survival of the free world, it's important that we are on the same page with our astronauts, with the aerospace researchers, with the radio control, traffic control officers, and all those thousands of people that have been reflected in the testimonies that we have heard. In fact, we have an answer to that skepticism years ago, which said, in effect, there's not a sufficient database for extraterrestrial science, but there is a sufficient database, thanks to people.
Valuable database.
Well, thank you for the kind words. There's very little that keeps us working in this field. As you all know, there's no pay, no benefits, no retirement. We live on an almost steady diet of ridicule, skepticism, and out-and-out condemnation. Not a very good diet over a long period of time, I have to emphasize. But a few kind words go a very long way in this field, and I am more than grateful for JJ's, Dr. Hertog's kind comments. Mm. It is a thankless task. But
well, not totally thankless. We're thanking you.
That's true. Almost thankless.
Almost practically thankless.
Extremely important. If my theory is correct, that we are being visited routinely, and it appears that way to me, and that's what the data say,
right,
then all of my work will have been justified, irrespective of whether there's been any kind of financial remuneration for my work.
You are a pioneer of in human consciousness and human exploration. I mean, it's...
I believe all of us who are interested in the field qualify for that title. Certainly my predecessor, I would like to... contribution over 20 years, Mr. Robert J. Gribble in Seattle, who founded the hotline mm-hmm. and ran it very effectively for 20 years and turned it over to me. So... that's
he
what
started
I
it. What year did he start the UFO?
He started the UFO Center in October 1974, about the time he retired from the Seattle Fire Department. He had a lifelong abiding interest in UFOs, but he had never seen one.
Right.
And he argued, this is, of course, before the days of the Internet, mm-hmm. he argued what we need is one facility, one location, where all or many reports will be submitted, where we can compare reports, where we can process them, where we can post them and farm them out to investigators for follow-up.
Did you?
So this is Desiree Hertog again. Peter, you got involved. Did you ever see anything?
Yes, I was going to ask you. Did you ever see anything, Peter?
Many people have gotten involved because there's been some experience.
Very nice question. Thanks for your interest, Desiree. Yes, and people can read my reports on my website. The reason, I believe, I am the director of the National UFO Reporting Center is because I saw a UFO as a child. I believe it was July of 1954, and moreover, I believe it was July 17th, but I'm not sure of the date. Seated in the right-hand seat, passenger seat of our family car at a drive-in theater at St. Louis Airport. People can read my extensive analysis and report of what I saw. It was very dramatic. We noticed that people in the drive-in theater started getting out of their cars, and there was some kind of disturbance. We didn't know if it was a fight or a fire or somebody was in what it was. But I remember very clearly, very vividly, even though this was 59 years ago, I remember this scene very vividly. Three men walked in front of our car looking up to my right, and I was a little bit annoyed because they blocked my view of the drive-in theater screen. I remember one guy was of modest stature, probably 5'6", had his cigarettes rolled up in the white sleeve of his T-shirt, as men were wont to do in the 1950s. Right. I remember all of this vividly, clearly. And they were looking up to my right. I turned my head to the right, so I was looking out the passenger window of the front seat of our family car, a 1953 green Studebaker. And there sat in the night sky a very bright object, red, the red of fire engine red, I would characterize it, and very bright. I think it was illuminating the ground around the theater and possibly even the airport. It was so bright.
How far off the ground was that?
Well, I can't say range. It's physically impossible to look at an object in the night sky and be able to determine range absent some kind of triangulation.
Right.
So I can't tell you how far it was. But its apparent size was equal to that of roughly a full moon in the night sky. It looked very much like the CBS television logo.
Mm-hmm.
And as I faced it out the right-hand side of our family car, it suddenly accelerated, and it followed an S-shaped path, a sigmoid path across the sky. It went behind the movie screen. That I remember. Uh-huh. And it disappeared over the horizon. It went right over McDonnell Aircraft Corporation on the north side of the St. Louis Airport and disappeared from sight, and it took it about 2 seconds to go from a dead stop over the horizon. It's covering 120 degrees of arc in 2 seconds from a dead stop to gone.
In the 1950s, which is amazing.
The 1950s.
Yeah. How old were you?
I was 6.5 years of age.
Never forgot it.
Wow.
And here's the interesting thing. There's something about this incident that interests me even more than the presence, apparent presence, mm-hmm. of a possible UFO. And that is the fact that nobody has reported it, except one lone UFO investigator who runs the National UFO Report. Why have all of those other witnesses, hundreds?
Well, there was no place to report it in the 50s, right?
I was there. Who else was there? That's what happened with Michael Sala.
Good point, Desiree. And I have done that. I have made appeals during radio programs.
St. Louis.
For anybody who lived in St. Louis, 1954.
George Norrie was probably there, right? Didn't he live in St. Louis?
I should tell this story to George. And
you should. Do you remember?
But he's too young.
Do you remember what movie was playing?
I don't remember the movie. That would tell me the date or the date range.
But it's interesting that Catherine Robert Sala was on today, and many people came forward on his panel because they heard him on CNN talk about his experience, and other people said, I had that experience, and they started coming out. One person
came out for
the first time today. He's never come out as a military
person.
Oh,
really?
Right?
We're talking about the citizens' hearings here in Washington. I'm here with Drs. Desiree and J.J. Hertog, along with Peter Davenport, along with a bunch of other military people and expert researchers like Richard Dolenz, Grant Cameron, Stanton Friedman. It's really like the top cast in the UFO world is here in Washington. Linda Moulton Howe is here.
Nick Pope.
Who else is here?
Roger Lear.
So tomorrow, if you tune in at 9 a.m. to the citizen panel hearings on disclosure, it's streamed live. Peter Davenport will give his witness testimony to members of Congress, former members of Congress. Are you excited?
I'm excited, a little apprehensive. I've never testified before members of Congress, but an interview like this gets me warmed up and gets me fighting mad. So it's done me. You've done me a great service in getting me warmed up for tomorrow's presentation.
We're the warm-up team here, thanks to. But thank you, Peter. Do you want to stick around, or you have to feel like you have to go and prepare?
I really should go and prepare and get some things done. But I'm delighted to have been a guest on the program. I hope I've shared some meaningful information with our group, and I'd like to leave them with the message that if they have ever, in at any time in their lives, it doesn't have to be recent, ever in their lives seen what they believe was a UFO, I encourage them to record the information, because if and when they
and send it to your website.
Send it to our website. When it comes that they leave this planet. If they have not written that down, all that information is lost, and that is exquisitely important information for us to have. So write it down, proofread it, if they would please, and submit it using our online report form.
You know, I didn't know that, because I've had at least 3 sightings, one in New York City, one in New Mexico, and one in Arizona, that I really only tell friends about, but I didn't realize there's an opportunity to still report. I thank you for saying. I thought it had to be current.
Archive it. It's very important. Yeah.
No, if a person saw a UFO 80 years ago, that information is almost as valuable, maybe even more valuable, than information would be if they had had the sighting just last night.
Wow.
So
I did not realize that, Peter. Thank you.
Brings to mind an experience I had. I can tell you the date, I believe. The second Saturday in September 2000. A gentleman called me in Seattle. He lived in Northgate, north end of Seattle, just north of Northgate Mall, if you know the city at all. Doctors Hertog know the location well. I can reveal this gentleman's name. It was Holger Berg. Very, very nice guy. And at the outset of the conversation, I cringed. Older fellow. Mm-hmm. And what he said is the following, and I'll try to recreate his voice and what he said. He said, "Mr. Davenport, I want you to sit down because I got a story I'm going to tell you." Well, when anybody starts off that way, I just cringe because I know there goes the hour.
But that's what you're there for, Peter.
Well, I'm there to take the calls. I'm not there to listen to the whole story.
Okay.
Because the point I try to make to people is talking about their UFO sighting doesn't do a bit of good. I equate it more often than not to sitting at a red light in a powerful pickup and racing the engine. It's a feel-good exercise. It draws interest and it attracts people's attention, but it doesn't do anything. What I'm trying to get people to do is write down the details. Capture the information. Talking about it doesn't capture the
information. But what happened with this old guy?
Well, he told me a story that I'm going to talk about tomorrow morning. And that is, he was a young teenager, probably 18, 19 years of age, in the year 1936. He was in Alaska. Mm-hmm. This was a Saturday night in October 1936. He was working at a CCC camp. He was a carpenter, and he had been hired to build this camp. He had a colleague who had traveled to Alaska that summer. His name was Peterson. The two of them were up there working together, and they liked to go from the camp in Aklutna, Alaska, 27 miles to the west, to Anchorage, to celebrate their one night out. Well, on this particular Saturday night, they worked 6 days a week. They put on their heavy jackets and they headed out to the highway to hitchhike into Anchorage. Mm-hmm. Well, they ran into something of exquisite nature. It flabbergasted. It frightened them so badly that they dove into a snowbank to get away from it. And you can read his report on our website for October of 1936, not the oldest report on our website by any means. We have reports out of the 1860s.
Oh, you do?
Absolutely.
I didn't realize
this
that.
Is not a phenomenon that started in 1947. It has been with us, it is my considered opinion, for probably millennia. And if it's been millennia, it could have been millions of years.
But it's also just American reports. I mean, sightings are all over Europe and South America.
Of course, and it's been around for a long time, but we feel there's more and more coming up recently, as you also pointed out. Once we've gotten the technology, they seem to be more and more around. And then once we got the nuclear technology, then they really appeared. And now it seems, as you said, in the last 10 months or 11 months, they're really back. And I think what's interesting is they're back in rows. They're not back with one light in the sky that you see somewhere. They're back as a whole flotilla.
But what happened in Alaska? What's, in a way, the punchline to that story?
Well, after the object left, it was a very interesting-looking object, he reported to me. And I hold this gentleman, late gentleman now, in very high regard, Holger Berg. He was a deacon of his local church. His wife told me that as far as she knew, he would never tell a fib like that. He was just the old school type fellow, and he told the truth. Well, he and his colleague, Peterson, dove into that snowbank and tried to conceal themselves from an object that looked like a flat iron. And it,
like a triangular shape.
Like a triangular shape.
That's common.
It radiated a very peculiar blue or blue-green light that they had never seen before, and it gave off a whining, buzzing sound.
Oh, really?
That does happen a lot in your reports, of some kind of droning or buzzing sound, right?
Absolutely. And he said it reminded him, the last 20 years of his working life, he worked for Boeing Aircraft Corporation. So he was working for them at the time the turbine engine was introduced into aviation. He said he could liken that sound only to the shutting down of a turbine aircraft, a turboprop. And he said it was the strangest thing he's ever experienced. Here's the clinching part of this. He tried to tell his, when he returned to the lower 48 United States, he tried to tell his family members about this. Mm-hmm. And the tragedy of this case is that they laughed at him. They would not believe him, even though they knew him to be an honest person by nature. And it is probably something that occurs frequently, but my message to people is if you've seen a UFO, you have to cut through the ridicule. You have to cut through the skepticism and the doubt.
Even your own skepticism and doubt.
Even your own. That's a good point I hadn't thought of.
Oh, sure. And people will see it one day and they'll say, nah, I didn't see anything, right? And I mean,
they try to have denial
of their own experience because it doesn't fit into their frame of reality. So, so even if you think you didn't see what you saw, send it in anyway.
Yes.
I have a question, though, on your reports. How many have had missing time? Is this something you put in your statement?
It's very difficult to know the answer to that, although I have had a number of reports like that that come to the question, Desiree. One in particular is the fireball that streaked over Ontario, Canada, Lake Erie, and Pennsylvania on the 25th of August, 1995, Friday morning. And a professional race car driver was driving on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and he saw this object. It's a long, long story. I won't get into all the details of it, but the long and short of it is that he reported to me after his first conversation to the hotline, he called me back about 20 or 25 minutes later, and he said, Mr. Davenport, there's one thing I forgot to tell you in recounting my story. And this is something that I have seen, a phenomenon I've seen often. It almost as if talking about the incident causes memories to rise to the conscious mind. He said, after the incident, for several nights following it, I started having dreams of triangular-shaped heads with almond eyes. Wow. What the significance of that is, I could only guess at. I have no idea. But it's a very interesting story.
Did he report missing time as well?
One doesn't necessarily experience or recognize missing time. All you know is there's an anomaly. Yeah. And this is the anomaly. I asked him what time the sighting occurred. We knew when that fireball had passed over the western end of Pennsylvania. And that was 40 minutes past midnight. And I asked him what time he had seen it. And he said, well, I saw it at 1:20 a.m. He was driving his race car to a professional race in Ohio, and time anomalies of that nature should alert a careful and prudent investigator to the possibility of, the term I prefer is interaction over abduction.
Wait, so the fireball was seen as 12:40, and he didn't report it till 1:20 and over 40 minutes later.
The fireball was seen at 40 minutes past midnight. He was on his way to Ohio on this Friday morning. He called me the following Monday and reported his sighting. And people can read the sighting for Breezewood, Pennsylvania, for 40 minutes past midnight on the 25th of August, 1995. But they can read his report.
A missing hour.
But he says he saw it at 1:20. He saw it or remembers seeing it at...
Yeah, he remembered having seen it at 1:20. And in cases like that, I assume the person's watch is set improperly, or they've changed time zones, so there's an apparent time anomaly. And I explored that with him because I was very interested to know whether he did in fact have some kind of interaction experience.
I think what's interesting is one of the Bentwaters testimonies that we heard today, when the military took over the case, that he believes he was given sodium pentothal to bring out information that he himself could not remember. So this is
he was given that by the Air Force itself.
Yes.
So, and then he actually didn't even remember what he said to the Air Force. I mean, that's one of the cases that's been investigated this week.
The idea is that there is this missing information that even the government or the certain levels of government understand takes place, that they need to have other ways to get that information out.
Do you have a lot of abductions reported, or mostly
not
some, but some?
There are a lot of people who report that they are regular abductees, but one has to take a lot of these reports with a grain of salt. I am a scientist, that is my background. And in the absence of data, you have nothing. Opinions don't matter.
Right.
They don't cut it in science. You need the data, the information, and then preferably, hopefully, you're able to analyze it and come up with the significance of it all.
Thank you, Peter, for your time here, and I'm going to pick up the program with Drs. Desiree Hertog and Dr. J.J. Hertog. We'll see you tomorrow. If you're listening, definitely tune in to Citizens Hearings.
At 9:05, Peter Davenport's going to be on, along with Linda Moulton Howe and Mike Heseltine. And that's talking about the various issues and sightings.
Good luck, Peter. Thank you for being a guest, and
we'll see you all tomorrow.
Yes, really. This has been excellent reporting. If you're in any way interested in you, thanks, Peter. We'll talk soon. I'll see you tomorrow, and I'll let you know where this will be posted, this particular interview.
Right. So we just want to say how exciting all this has been.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say that people like Lori, do you want to say something about Lori? Have Lori here, who also was involved with the Sirius movie that Sirius Rosenfeld, the movie that was just put out connected to the Stephen Greer investigations. But right now, just to wrap up the whole week, let's give like a sort of overview. And of course, the doctors Hertog, JJ, and Desiree have been involved in UFO research for the last 20 or 30 years. 40 years for Dr. Hertog. He's giving me the hand signal. So I think this week is really key as a reorientation to the public about all the core matters in the UFO world.
Well, that's why it's called a citizens' hearing. Now, we're not really expecting that the government is going to make that change and say, yes, UFOs are real. In fact, I think some of the synopsis is that the press and the government is really not that interested. So it's really boiling down to the people. But yet, we have some really top people, mostly military or people who have investigated the military sightings, who are coming forward. And tomorrow, in addition to Peter Davenport, we also have Jesse Marcel's kids, if I can put it that way.
Well, Jesse Marcel is one of the people at Roswell who took the wreckage for the Air Force, held this crashed craft, and brought it home to his house. His son was, 6 years old at the time, and held this wreckage as well.
So he actually saw it. Yeah. He confessed to his family, which many people don't. Today, there was a man who had the experience 40 years ago and said, I never even told my wife. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like shocking for the whole auditorium that he never even told his wife. Jesse Marcel said, oh, hell with it. I'm telling my family. I'm showing my family. And they saw the wreckage. They saw some of the remains.
Of course, we have to say Jesse Marcel was then forced later to deny everything that he found and say it was a crashed weather balloon. And you can see that famous picture of him looking up and saying, like, really? You want me to lie about this?
But his family knows different. And so right. does Stan Freeman and other people who will be part of the panel tomorrow.
Right. Dr. Hertog, you've been in this field for 4 decades. And you have a great overview of the situation. How do you feel about these citizen hearings and what it's going to accomplish?
First of all, I wanted to thank all of who are listening to your program, showing interest in this subject. As I stated to some of the congressmen and women that have been part of the panel, we are reaching a point of critical mass that we either will go forward with this knowledge or fall back, possibly into oblivion. The slide towards technical self-destruction, the environmental situation hovering on biospheric collapse, as we know. Desiree and I were presenters at the Rio Plus 20 conference this past year in Rio, Brazil, on these critical issues of change. The massive sightings that we know from governments throughout the world suggest that we need to have a global commons. And so this is the first step of moving, as it were, the discussion, the dialogue, the debate into a much larger arena, hopefully ultimately at the United Nations. We're top specialists on committee levels, on international levels, can say that we as a humanity need to realize this is to our advantage in the, at this crossroads of history, to see that we have positive counterparts for what I call the cosmic others.
You know, I just wanted to ask you, because, you know, I talk to a lot of people about consciousness, and they seem to think that the UFO question is irrelevant to consciousness. And I say, what are you talking about? There's no better reason for evolving consciousness to know that we're part of a greater civilization.
Yeah, exactly. Linda Moulton Howe said this yesterday at her panel session. And if you can go back and see that, I think it was incredible.
I think the most important aspect of this hearing is consciousness is part of the upswing or the self-realization that we're all moving into, that we have not only human consciousness, but we have also what I call higher consciousness to co-evolve the direction of evolution.
Right.
Alan, you know that we feel that there's many different types of extraterrestrials that are visiting the planet, but this last session that we were just listening to was on nuclear tampering, and you have Captain Robert Salas and Bruce Fenstermacher, and all of them are saying that they were here, they saw the extraterrestrial spacecraft, or they at least were part of the witness of the reports where the nuclear missiles in the silos were actually neutralized. So there has to be a consciousness behind it. That was one of the things they said, that they have to be, it's almost a warning for planet Earth not to use nuclear weapons. So that's one aspect.
Right.
And then Linda goes back yesterday and says about how the mind is able to communicate, that people, that these extraterrestrials, for the most part, they can talk, but basically they put thought forms into your head. They actually can feed you with information. And that's how they work. That's how they operate.
Well, I brought this up because there's a sort of delusion among the spiritual New Age consciousness that we should ignore or not pay attention to what's out there. And, I've interviewed really the tops in the field, and they just don't get how important this is. I want to get a comment, except for the Hertogs, of course, but I want to get a comment from Lori Rosenfeld, who's part of the CE5.
I'm involved with a group who our website is etletstalk.org, and what we do is we are initiating human contact with ET, and we do it through allowing ourselves to go through somehow reach theta or delta states, because one of the things I say, because what, let me backtrack just a moment. We are very aware that ET doesn't speak English. we want to make this really simple. We know that each of us, through our own consciousness, through our own awareness, through source, through one mind, we are all connected. The beauty of what's happening now is that we are at a time where spirituality is meeting, science and spirituality are meeting.
Right. And it's meeting in the extraterrestrial arena because this is what's going to evolve human civilization. That's the only, people have been talking about consciousness for thousands of years, but we have the choice now as a planet to move together as one humanity.
So we can talk about the global mind, but we can also talk about the cosmic mind. And when we get into the cosmic mind is when we start getting into these other realms of intelligence.
Right.
So, and what we the way we and our groups come to terms with it, again, keeping in very lay terms, partly just because that's the way I can communicate. I'm not a scientist, but I believe and because through my own experiences, I understand and I've been able to access what I understand is described as higher realms of consciousness. That that ET is able to speak to us as because we each have a frequency signature as clear as a fingerprint, and so that when we go into this place through the heart as well, at where the heart and mind join together, then we're able to reach out and communicate with the many different levels of and kinds of ET that are speaking to us.
But I would also say when you're doing it with a higher love and a greater open consciousness, but also that spirituality, you're reaching the best levels of ET, or right.
There's some levels of ET that don't have any concept of heart or mind.
So they wouldn't be tuning into Laura.
Right. Won't bother. It's not about bothering, but there's so much diversity of consciousness, as I'm sure you know, Dr. Hertog. That we are tuning into certain frequencies of extraterrestrial consciousness, but there's an array, an infinite bunch of levels of frequency
many
in the universe.
Civilizations out there for various purposes.
So
back in the early 70s, I was involved with biofeedback studies at the University of California and had the opportunity to work with some of the candidates for the program of outer space, young astronaut training program. And I knew astronaut Mitchell, who, when he was on the famous Apollo journey to the moon, tried to communicate successfully to two human biological targets on Mother Earth without telling NASA officialdom that he was going to try to use consciousness.
The power of the mind.
And this sort of broke the records in terms of scientific communication skills by showing the existence of mind over matter. He went on to found the Noetics Institute in California with very gifted thinkers and workers who also, like ourselves as futurists, have pursued a much higher blueprint that we see the ET question or ETI, extraterrestrial intelligence, as an opportunity of growth and successful quantum change reality that we will be faced with.
Well, you know, it's interesting about the Mitchell case because he did have that sort of oneness, Satori experience in space, and I wonder if the telepathic communications that he was delivering helped him get into that state of transcendence. So what's the relation?
Definitely did, because in a recent film, which I recommend through our website, keysofenoch.org, you can acquire what is called a new documentary entitled Wisdom of the Wayshowers, and he is one of 10 speakers speaking of the reality of extraterrestrial races that he knows about through his clearances, his background, his work with really the upper end of the scientific communication spectrum.
Well, did he have that telepathic experience before his epiphany or after?
The epiphany came when he was out in space looking at the small blue-green planet to realize we're all one.
Well, when did he have the telepathic communication with the people on Earth?
Yeah, about the same time. But I think what's interesting is that in space, perhaps there is that energy that is less of the global mind, less of the duality that we're living in, less of all of that. So we're kind of breaking the barriers right now. And I think there's many reasons why we're starting to reach out into outer space and be part of that universal mind, that cosmic mind. But I think when you're in space, and many other astronauts, even those in Russia, have had unique experiences being outside the field of the earth.
Well, even meditating in the middle, like when it's really quiet, it's much easier to meditate when all the mental activity has stopped. So imagine being in space where there's not a lot of mental activity. You have a really clear direction of thought, which gets us back to these ETs that you are communicating with and the nature of that.
What we're finding is that people are spontaneously and sometimes not so spontaneously having these experiences.
What kind of experiences?
Experiences where they are accessing ET, and ET is very creative about how they communicate, but it does start with the group, usually a group who comes together and either through guidelines or practices or meditation allows himself to go into that higher state of consciousness, and then allows ET to communicate. And so through electrical devices, through computers, I've heard of interesting messages that come through cell phones. We have all sorts of, as in addition to the usual sightings, lights in the sky, flashes.
Well, this is one evidence of humanity's evolution. Wouldn't you say so, Dr. Herzog?
Yes, we're going into a new chapter, what I will call a new image of humanity that's being forged. And we see here through the work of Linda Moulton Hall and Stanton Friedman, other gifted
Steve
speakers,
Bassett,
like Steve Bass and Steve Greer and others, the connecting of the dots. And this is why our Academy for Future Science was set up in 1973 after my own experience with what I call ultra-terrestrial intelligence, looking at the spiritual, philosophical consciousness side of this question of identity without expanding our consciousness and realizing the gifts that astronaut Mitchell and others have shown us, not only through distant communication, but, for example, what was done at Stanford Research Institute, remote viewing, the ability to communicate through the power of the mind at any place in the local universe on the planetary surface, is again a great boon to the power of our mind, our intelligence reaching out. So it's really existential EQ, existential quotient that's being advanced rapidly, which brings us all together.
Yeah. And what I will mention, Alan, is the fellow who, and these protocols were first created by Dr. Stephen Greer. And the fellow who had been volunteering and working with him, Costa McCreese, created about 3 years ago, took upon himself to get as many people together once a month at the new moon, which is the darkest time, to invite people to go out over the course of 24 hours to create a morphogenic field, which I'm sure Dr. Curtis
A morphogenetic field, yes.
Where we do, and we're all of those, one of the wonderful things about the community is it's really about getting beyond the constraints of traditional religion and really becoming awareness of the spirituality of humanity as one. And that's, you know, and in doing that, reaching ET finds a place to reach us.
Right. What's the name? How do we find your organization?
We're under www.etletstalk.org.
I'm talking to Laurie Rosenfield, who's here in Washington from Toronto, but these CE5 groups are all over the country, and you can go to ET Let's Talk and find out.
And you'll be able to access through our form, through newsletters and all that. I'm not very good at publicizing, I guess
everybody
can hear that we have a great map that we use, that people can find groups locally, or have an opportunity to create their own group. And we're just starting. We've only been around for 6 months. And we are a growing and evolving organization, and our intention is very much to connect and to associate and affiliate with other people who are working together towards ultimate first open contact, is what we call it. Yeah.
And CE5 groups are featured prominently in the film Sirius, which has just come out, which is an investigation into Stephen Greer's work. So to wrap up here in Washington, this has been a very exciting week and continues to be. Yes,
I wanted to say that we are now with a new edition of The Keys of Enoch, which 1973 pointed out that there would be a major change and consciousness between 2003 and 2004, with the recognition that there was a cosmic intelligence, cosmic others, have knocked on the doors of 18 governments who've come clean and have admitted the need and importance of disclosure. And so all of this comes together at the most auspicious time where we realize the advantages certainly outnumber the disadvantages of people who are scared to come forth, to share information, to share ecumenical consciousness, to bring the spiritual and scientific together, and to realize, well, we know in the ancient tradition of the prophets, the Etz Chaim, the tree of life, right, with all the branches of knowledge and science in harmony with the human race growing up.
Right, and I think we just have to stop the laughter curtain, which is what people are trying to do at this conference. We're having to find ways of getting the information out ourselves because we can no longer wait for the governments to do that, whether it's in technology, which I think is also a fascinating area that's going to be brought out because we do have new technologies, some of which have been inspired by other levels of intelligence, and just to be able to say that this is happening worldwide, all over the planet.
Well, what's so great about this meeting, hearing, is that so many people from different factions in the UFO world, we have military people, we have investigators like Linda Moulton Howe, Richard Dolenz, and we have generals like, who was the colonel who testified? French. Lieutenant who actually was part of Project Blue Book.
And we're concluding with Paul Hellyer from Canada, from the ministry up there, and also Stephen Bassett, who really brought all this
together.
Yes,
we have to thank Stephen Bassett for bringing this.
And I have to say the main thing that I think is really happening, because one of the big questions is, okay, some of these events took place in the 60s and 70s. What's happening now? And what Peter was saying is that it's much more massive sightings. Not only are there more, but there's more than one light in the sky, oftentimes flying in triangular formation, sometimes in like the Phoenix lights, multiple lights coming together.
And I also think more people are open to it. They've heard it in fictional films, on television.
But there's more sightings as well. Even though you don't read about it in the newspaper, someone like Peter Davenport, someone like MUFON, and people like A.J. Gerard or Jaime Maussan are getting this information.
Well, I just wrote an article for my website about the FBI file, about the Hoddle memo, and the fact that the FBI is saying so many people are looking at this one file about UFOs, and they're saying, why not look at our crime memos?
But it's obvious. They're not looking at Dillinger and all these other people. They're looking at UFOs.
They're obviously, people want to know about this. And the FBI and CNN can't understand why. I said, why? Because people are interested in this.
And that was out of an event in the 40s or something like that. So it's not even a current event.
So people are desperate for this. So please tune in. You can go to the paradigmresearchgroup.org. You can go to Citizens Hearings on
futurescience.org, which is our
FutureScience.org. You can go to newrealities.com. You can go to ET Let's Talk. But to see the streaming of the testimony, and tomorrow they go into Roswell with
CitizensHearing.org
or Citizens Hearing on Disclosure. It's also being tweeted to the Huffington Post every hour. So this is really current. It's very exciting. It's really the latest breaking news in the UFO world, and I think it's going to move our planet to a new level of consciousness. So I want to thank all my guests for being here.
And I want to thank you, Ellen, for your great and courageous pioneering work.
I don't know why I'm so obsessed with the with the idea, but I saw something, and I feel really connected. I feel it is humanity. It's our destiny to return to the stars, or at least acknowledge where we've come from on some level. So thank you. Thank you, Lori Rosenfield from ET Let's Talk, Drs. J.J. Hertog, Dr. Desiree Hertog from Future Science, and the keysofenoch.org, and I'm Alan Steinfeld. We had Peter Davenport from his UFOCenter.com, where you can report a UFO, and we're here live in Washington, D.C. for the citizens' hearings. Thanks for tuning in. You can send comments to me at newrealities.com and also email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening tonight, and I appreciate all the comments that you've been sending.